Hello and welcome back to the Brasscast. I am your host Zoe Wright and today I have the absolute pleasure of being joined by the legendary cornet player Philip McCann. Now if you're listening to this and you have never heard of Philip before, you must be living under a rock because Philip is quite possibly the world's most famous cornet player. Philip was the principal cornet of the Black Dyke Mills Band from 1973 to 1988 during the band's world-beating period and one of the most successful bands in history. Additionally, he is universally admired for his exquisite tone and musical expression in his playing. Philip has always been firmly committed to the teaching of brass band music and served for almost 30 years at the University of Huddersfield, including a period as head of brass and woodwind. In 2019, he was awarded an honorary doctorate in recognition of his services to music and education. And I could go on and on about the vast amount of experiences that he has, but I'm sure we'll delve into this throughout this episode. And before we dig in, I'd like to say a massive thank you to Philip for giving up his time and being a part of this episode, because it's an absolute pleasure to be able to sit and chat to you this evening.
It's my pleasure. And before we start, I'd like to congratulate you, actually, Zoe, for your vision to actually do this project and to have the courage and the determination to actually make it happen. So bravo to you, and I'll always totally support people like yourself doing things like this. As I say, well done, bravo.
Oh, thank you. We'll delve right in. So first of all, could you just tell us when and why you started playing?
I think I was about 7 years old. Well, I was 7 years old, and I'm from a small town in Scotland, and the town is called Bowness. I can see it quite clearly. I was actually with my grandfather, and we're just standing in the middle of the town, and I remember the Salvation Army band playing, actually, Bowness Salvation Army band. And the funny things that stick in your mind, I can remember the cornet player who are and were a famous family in the world of Salvation Army music and brass banding. And the surname was Spowett. But I can remember the cornet player. I was only seven, so I was just a titch. But this cornet player looked like an absolute giant in height. You know, probably 6 foot six to 7 foot in my eyes then. But a superb player. And I think that he went on to actually play with the ISB, perhaps. A really, really good player. But that was the sort of trigger, really, that pulled something in me to want to play in a brass band. I had no family involvement prior to that. And as I say, I was just literally standing there listening with my grandfather, and he or my parents, I can't remember which to be exact, took me along on a Sunday morning to the local band. There are two bands in Bowness. One is called Bowness in Carradon, and the one I went to on the west side of Bowness was Kinneil Colliery Silver Band. I think they're now called, well, they are now called Unison Kinneil Band. And that's how it basically started, going along on the Sunday morning.
Wow, that's so lovely to hear. You know, I started playing because I've got older brothers and they play. And it's nice to hear when people start just because they hear it and they're like, oh, I want to do that. And, you know, it's a lovely story to hear.
This is the thing about it. I mean, what is that trigger? I'm quite Christian in private with my beliefs, etc. And from my point of view, obviously, we're all given a sort of magical talent in whatever. It doesn't have to be just music. It can be in any part of our life. And something just happened. I went along and I was given an instrument. I didn't ask for a cornet. I was given a cornet. Perhaps it could have just as easily been a tenor horn, or even worse, a euphonium or trombone. But that's just as simple as that. And then it was, I can't remember how long, but we used to go on a Sunday morning for an hour, and a small group of us of similar ages, 7, 8, 9, 10-ish, and beginning was that. And we used to just begin with, obviously, trying to learn the notes and how to play the instrument. The chap taking the group, being a local band, and they were in the fourth section then, by the way, was the bass trombone player from the senior band. So he was trying his best, bless him, to help us youngsters fulfil the enthusiasm that we had.
Amazing. That's really, really amazing. So you've played and performed and conducted all over the world. Could you choose a favourite venue that you've had the chance to perform in?
Wow. Yeah, I am extremely lucky. In all my life in banding, I've never gone seeking or networking or looking for things. It's always been people who have come to me and asked me to do this from the point of view of playing. I think one of the, I guess there's two or three. When I was about 14, I was still at school, a band called Yorkshire, as it was, Yorkshire Imperial Metals near Leeds, brought me down and my family. They provided a house for my parents and some work for my mum and dad. So I played with them for 2-3 years. But then the Fairy Band, Fairy Engineering it may have been then, enticed or asked me. As I say, I didn't audition. And they asked me via Harry Mortimer at the time to become their principal cornet player, taking over from a legendary cornet player called Norman Ashcroft, who had been principal cornet with the band through its heyday. 20 plus years with the Harry Mortimer conducting, etc. I think the first thing that comes to mind in the special thing is going to Canada. I mean, from a little town in Bowness, suddenly you're playing principal cornet with the Fairy Band, and then there's a massive concert trip to Canada. We were based in Niagara, and we used to do concerts going out from Niagara to different places like London, which was in Ontario. So that was a special occasion. There wasn't what I would call special venues. So I guess I would have to come down in my time at Black Dyke. The one that is most, well, no, we'll say two, playing in Sydney Opera House and principal cornet with Black Dyke, standing up and playing solos, as well as obviously playing principal cornet for the local concert. That was just one of those occasions and memories that you can never, ever forget and always be grateful that you managed to fulfill that type of dream. The other one, obviously, in the UK would be the Royal Albert Hall. But I had already played there when I was 12, you know, when I was still at Kinneil. I think I was about 12, and we'd got to the championship section in the 3 or 4, not because of me, but in my first 3 or 4 years at Kinneil from 7-year-old, we came straight up through the sections. So when I was 12, I was sitting on the Royal Albert Hall stage. So you've got both extremes, 12-year-old, the Royal Albert Hall, which you don't really take in at that age. You know what I mean?
No, not at all.
12-year-old, and you're just, okay, we'll just play. But by the time I was in Black Dyke and halfway through my tenure, perhaps, or maybe a bit more, and then you're in the Sydney Opera House, it's just, wow. But there's been so many, many memorable, special, magical occasions. Those are the two extremes.
Yeah, Sydney Opera House, I mean, you're very lucky to have been performed there. I mean, it's on like a bucket list of places that I want to go and see, let alone be able to go and play inside it.
Well, you will do it. If you want to do it, you will do it.
Maybe one day.
No, not maybe, you will.
So it goes without saying that you have the most recognisable cornet sound in the world, without a doubt. And there's no one before you that has come after you that comes anywhere near to your sound. So where did you get the inspiration for it to be so distinct and so wonderful? Where did you get the inspiration for it if it had never come before you?
I don't think there was an inspiration. I'm not trying to sound arrogant. It's certainly not intended to be arrogant. But I still come back to, you're playing tenor horn and a young, talented tenor horn player. You're helped by teachers to become better. And your conductor, Morgan, at Hammond's, helping you in the band scene as well with your repertoire there. But somewhere along the line, you on tenor horn or me on cornet, something is given to us. That now, how that is given to you obviously comes back to your beliefs. Like I say, I've brought up in a strong Catholic family. I just have to believe that I was given. I've not really tried to produce anything other than my sound from being 7-year-old. Obviously, the instruments have changed through the course of my life, in the sense of the technique of the instrument or the technical aspect of the instruments. But I think it's a good question in more ways than one, because I think it's a good thing for people. I could reverse the question. You mean you may listen to some wonderful tenor horn player that you absolutely adore and think, oh, that's an amazing sound. But I think it's dangerous to want to sound like that. But I think it's nice to be inspired by someone and to have that inspiration from someone. And maybe it's dangerous to imitate them, because I always think it's better to be a first-class version of you than a second-class version of someone else. And I think you will find your own natural sound, which you're doing, I know, because I've heard you, and it's an absolutely gorgeous, true, what I would call traditional, how the tenor horn should sound. So please don't ever lose that. And it's that to me is how it is. I have a sound that is me. Now, I think, sadly, it seems perhaps a shame that people have lost, to a certain extent, an identity. I mean, I've always listened not to brass players as much as a violin player or world-famous opera singers for inspiration of how to shape things, etc., and shape the melodies and phrases, etc. But as regards the sound, it's from within. You have to, I keep saying to students over the years, it gets a bit corny to them, perhaps being younger, but you really do have to trust your own heart and your own feelings. And if the music you're playing is sad or happy or romantic, you've got to somehow find that in your playing, to find the heart of you and your sound. And then use your sound, really use it, to express your feelings to people that are listening.
Yeah, I completely agree. You know, performing pieces, trying to play and through sound and phrasings and all sorts, what emotions are being portrayed through the music. I completely agree with what you're saying.
As a young player, if I said to you, and you don't have to put names on things, but if you sit and listen at a contest, or we'll say a contest because there's many bands there, if you hadn't the vision, if you just closed your eyes and couldn't see, is there many players that you could actually identify?
Probably not. No. To be honest with
and
you,
that's what I find sad. And I'm not saying good, bad or indifferent. I'm not judging that aspect of it, but one of the things I treasure, and people outside banding as well, is, like you've said, and you're a very young, up-and-coming musician, people hear me, whether it could be on the radio or a CD or whatever, and they know it's me. Now that, good, bad or indifferent, it's up to them whether they think that's a great sound or an average sound or it's whatever. It's nice to know that your sound is being identified.
So not just, you've touched on there, but not just in the brass band community, has your sound become so well loved and so recognisable? You know, it's worldwide recognisable, especially for the theme tune in Hetty Wainthrop Investigates that I saw circulating on over Christmas. It was on some of the TV channels. But when you were kind of younger, and as we were just talking about kind of finding your sound, did you kind of know how audiences and people would react to it and how they would love it, or were you just doing you and the love for it developed naturally?
I think mostly. I think, you know, and if I ever, and I very rarely listen to brass band recordings, and I very, very rarely listen to all the recordings I've done, whether it's the solo CDs or with Black Dyke, etc. I don't seem to have the patience. It's the same at band contests. I very rarely, unless I'm on the odd occasion adjudicating, well, then you've got to listen in detail to every band. But I just much prefer listening for inspiration, musical inspiration, to the orchestras and the great singers of the world. I think on the odd occasions that I have, if I had to go back and listen to the very first recording I ever did with Yorkshire Imperial Metals, and I was only about 14, I think, In fact, there was two songs on it. One was The Sunshine of Your Smile, a great Victorian ballad. And the other one was Somewhere a Voice is Calling, another great Victorian ballad. And then if I listened to one or two solos that I did at Fairies, in the Alpine Echoes, or Fairies of the Waters by San Jacome, solos like that, something's changed. Not so much in the inherent quality of the sound or the expressiveness, but it's like a voice. I mean, I've mentioned the word voice so many times, and a voice matures. The greatest opera singers, when they're 17 or 18 or 22 or 28 or 30, their voice is maturing. And I think this happens by virtue of physically we're maturing more as well. And then I go to Black Dyke and listen to all the solos I've recorded there, all the five volumes of the most beautiful melodies and the solos outside that on other recordings with Black Dyke, and just the general playing. There's a maturity happening, which is in a natural way. And then I think emotionally, your own emotions, you know, when we're young, we're very, well, in my experience, young players, young musicians, they're very sort of shy or embarrassed to say, oh, this is how I feel, just to use the word feel, or to feel the word love in the playing, or express themselves in the playing. It's probably a natural thing. We have this sort of shyness and embarrassment about it all, instead of just saying, look, this is how I feel, this is how I'm going to try and sound and play. So there is this physical and emotional maturity happening as we're growing. But I think the basic core, the basic sound is, I would like to think, remaining the same. Again, you see, when you mention Hetty, it's, that must be nearly 30 years ago since we started that. About seven series of an hour long each episode. And there were six or seven episodes in each series. So there was like nearly 50 episodes in total over a period of a number of years, because we didn't just do it once. Every episode, I had to go to London and being in the orchestra, in the studio, recording every episode, because it's amazing when people, I mean, if we took music away from what we can see in films and TV, it's surprising how much little bits of incidental music there is that helps the drama. Mm-hmm. And I used to travel down very early in the morning, because it was two sessions, 9 till 12 and 1 till 4, and that was it. It had to be done in that time, each episode. There was maybe something like 30-plus little segments of music that we had to do, the orchestra and myself, and of course being the main voice from the theme and mostly in other parts of each episode. You had one or two goes at it, and it's all sight reading. You don't get it in advance.
No.
You have to arrive, do it, and that's it. So you've had that for 30 years on now, and it's still being repeated. I mean, I even see, being Scottish, the royalties that arrive to me still. I mean, it's been sold all over the world. I mean, we see it, and it's well known in various ways in the UK, but it's been sold to Canada and Australia and New Zealand, even Monte Carlo, in places that you wouldn't even associate with brass bands.
Oh, wow.
And obviously it was produced as a brass band setting, which everybody virtually buys and tries to use at some point or other. And it won a very special award, the Ivor Novello Award. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that was a wonderful experience to do. And again, you know, I mean, from my point of view, the satisfaction of taking a brass band instrument, the cornet, and taking it out into the world for people to hear that have no idea what a brass band is.
No, it's incredible.
You go back in my time, which isn't that long, I'm older than I look, going back to Howard Snell, when he was in his heyday conducting Britannia, Fordham's, Desford, when I was at Black Dyke, and he was the one that really created the opening the door, shall we say, for brass band students to go to the Northern, because prior to that, there was no, you know, I mean, if you played a cornet or a tenor horn or a euphonium, you wouldn't get in. But then the doors opened. And the same with universities. When I started 30 years ago at Huddersfield, you know, it was just on the cusp of going from one to the other as well. It was like, if trumpet or French horn, yeah. Because when I started there, there wasn't really a brass band, and there certainly wasn't a wind orchestra. But the doors opened around that period, and Howard was a great pioneer, especially to give it credibility at the Royal Northern. And obviously it's flourished to what it is today. Yeah. And it should, because people like you would never have been able to go there because you played a tenor horn.
I'm very, very lucky that I do get the chance to do that. So in your playing career, you've had some extremely memorable contest performances in particular, and we could sit and talk about them all day long. However, I just want to pick one out because it's one that I've heard about, and in particular, you can probably guess which one I'm on about, is that 1982 Yorkshire Areas of contest music with Black Dyke. And you know how special that performance has become of you holding that top C sharp so perfectly and longer than anybody else. Did you know when you were walking on stage how long you were going to hold that note for?
No. But I knew I was going to hold it long. I mean, it's funny really, because just before, I mean, you're talking about C sharp, and I will properly, fully answer your question, but just before Christmas, or was it just after, there was somebody from my home band, Keneal. They got in touch with me saying somebody in the band is having a special birthday. Would I send a video myself and just do a little message, and then they'll present it to her on a Zoom meeting with the band that same night as a surprise, because for some reason she loves my playing, etc. So I thought, well, okay, I'll also play Happy Birthday. So the key I played it in, I just at the end I went up to a top C, even to just a couple of weeks ago. I mean, I just thought, I enjoy this. I'll just hold it for 10, 15 seconds and then talk after it. And it was the same with the C-sharp. It didn't really, in my head, and again, not arrogantly, because just to make the notes sing with the proper technique, I was always comfortable. I mean, I just thought, and I wasn't sitting there counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 15 or 16 seconds or whatever it was. I just want to hold it, because it did say Lunga, and okay, I'm going to play it long. And I just held it and held it. And actually, for me, in my head, although it was always okay, the technical aspect in reality for me was the leap down to the low F sharp after it, smoothly. I mean, to go from up there and slurred down to the F sharp on the first bass, smoothly, without any gaps, without any sort of little glissandi effect. To do that was, for me, the biggest challenge. It always happened, but then it's always in the practice and the preparation. But I enjoyed sitting up there, falling down to the F sharp, when I just thought, well, I don't want to push it, because, you know, and there's a little red flag, you know, and some people might with anything, and not just that high C sharp, but they always maybe just think, I'll just show off. Once you start showing off, which I wasn't doing, you know, and it never entered my mind that I was going to do it longer than anyone else or blah, blah, blah. It, to me, it wasn't a contest to do it. I just did what I felt and then moved off it. But I think some people can get into this contest, nearly sport-like attitude in their heads, and then become a cropper. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly what I wasn't going to do, because having floated up there, I knew instinctively when it was time to leave it to go down to the lower sharp. So that's... yeah, a big lesson, I think. Some people just maybe compete too much, in that you can't go on a stage to prove that you're better than someone else. I've never done that. I've always gone on wanting to not let the band down and be the best I can be for the band. Yeah. Not be better than another cornet player, just be the best I can be for the band.
Absolutely.
Like you do on tenor horn for Hammond.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Did you know at the time how kind of legendary that performance would become?
No. But there's so many things which I'm blessed to. I could give the same answer to so many things. When I've done recordings or played wherever, I didn't think at the time, 40 years on, people are still going to be talking about how you sound and what blah, blah, blah. Because I'm just still trying my best today equally as I did then. Well, obviously, you know that as well, because I do a concert with every Christmas with Hammonds and yourself. So
yeah,
it matters just as much today as it did then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it will always be that way. I think as soon as it is less for me, there'll never be any in between. Mm. It's either all or nothing.
Yeah.
And if I ever thought my sound is naff, I wouldn't play.
That's fair enough. And hopefully you keep on playing for...
I shall try.
As long as possible.
So the time that you were at Black Dyke was a long tenure, but also a successful time for the band. The band was pretty unbeatable. What do you think made Black Dyke so successful during that time?
I think it's like a lot of things in life. I mean, first and foremost, the previous 150 years or 140 odd years, as it was when I first went, that is a heritage that you have to take on. You have to live up to that. And when you joined the band in those days, anyway, you were always, even Principal Cornet, and I didn't audition, I probably did unknowingly audition, but I didn't apply to be the Principal Cornet at Black Dyke. They asked me, and it worked out. But even when you joined, Principal Cornet, Third Cornet, Solo Horn, Second Horn, doesn't matter what you were, there was always someone, or more than one, who would take you to one side and point out quite strongly, there's always been a better player than you sat on your chair before you. And every time you put this jacket on, etc., you've got to do this and do that. And not just the playing, in every aspect. But it's always made quite clear what it entails to be part of that band, as it was then. And we had so many great characters who were there prior to me. And I think it wasn't a matter of, it's a different generation now, but we had a situation of all the right ingredients perhaps coming together at the right time. Mm. I think it was, again, I really don't mean this in any arrogant way or from my point of view, I was part of it. But I think all the ingredients were there at the right time. The right inductor arrived at the same time. And then we just instinctively, mostly, we worked like crazy, practicing at home and practicing in the band room for rehearsals and preparation for concerts and contests, etc. But it became an instinct. Obviously, the relationship with me and the conductor Major Park, as well as the residents who, you know, people like Roy Newsome or Derek Broadbent, you mean those sort of resident conductors. But the main scenario of me and Major Parks literally singing from the same song sheet. I mean, when he was conducting, he was always singing, whether it was a test piece or a concert piece or whatever, he was doing what I was doing as a player. So immediately you have that locking in of musical instinct. But then I think, and this is where the important relationship of the cornet player and the conductor, which I had similar when I took Carlton Main for 5 or 6, 7 years with Kirsty, who was my student. He knew what I felt. So we could then take the band with us. And musically, that's how it all gelled, I think, with Black Dyke. So it came to the point they knew how I was going to play something, whether it was a test piece or a concert. And the style of playing, I think, I helped push the dynamic range of the band because I could play softer. So once you start getting soft, not the difference between quiet and soft, you mean having soft, warm sounds as opposed to weak sounds. Then when you play the double 40s, etc., that has more impact. And then we were all pushing each other. John Clough on euphonium, or Sandy Smith on horn, or Kevin Crockford on soprano, all those players, we would really subconsciously push each other. When John Clough stood up sometimes playing some of his solos, then his encore, he would play some of them. I think Morgan mentioned it. I mean, he would be playing them so soft, and the band is really, really on the edge. But we had this, pushing each other. But there was no standards for contests and standards for week in, week out. Every rehearsal was equally important. If you made a mistake in a rehearsal, again, maybe it's the generation, but I mean, I see it in some band rooms, and you know, I mean, there's a mistake and people have a laugh, which is okay, I guess, but we couldn't. You know, you got one, not just one, you had a few people giving you quite a glower and a stare that would kill you at 20 paces, just if you made a little slip in the band room in a rehearsal. So that mentality, keeping that standard really up there 52 weeks of the year, when you came to the contest, all you had to do was lift it a little bit more. Whereas perhaps, I think some bands are too relaxed in between the contests with the way they play, maybe a little bit too sloppy, maybe they don't care quite as much about the dynamics and the precision and the rhythms, etc. And then it's a bigger leap to bring it up for a contest, whereas we had the mentality, every rehearsal, every concert, and nobody missed.
No.
There was no professionals. Everybody had a job doing whatever. Mm-hmm. And that, again, leads to this instinctive musical ensemble team spirit stroke musicianship, because everybody just felt what I was going to do, or what John Clough was going to do, or Sandy Smith, or Kevin Crockford. We all knew more or less before it happened. And some of the recordings we did, I mean, we were being handed the music on the day.
Wow.
And play through it, and then we record. And the precision and the rhythms are because of that instinctiveness and close-knit playing. And it wasn't a matter of everyone being the greatest of friends. I mean, sometimes I know I'm quite single-minded about a lot of the approach that I have outside the rehearsals, outside the band rooms. You know, I mean, the people that know me, that matter in my life, know me obviously slightly differently. But you could have a person, you know, I've had an assistant principal, and you talk in rehearsals, but that's the only time you saw that person. Mm. And the same with the other players. I mean, they could have really big arguments at the end of rehearsals about this, that, and the other. But once that was done, that was it. It was all, everybody knew what was happening, and it was done and dusted. And as soon as you put your jacket on, the uniform, it was, well, it couldn't be closer, literally, in every sense, musically. And all that mattered was playing for the name of that band and for the uniform you had on. No stars. I mean, I can't recollect once ever coming off, having played quite a lot of fairly difficult solos at contests under probably the greatest pressure because of the seat. Nobody ever came and slapped you on the back and said, oh, that's what was expected.
Mm, yeah.
But now you've got people back slapping on stage and applauding themselves on stage, and you think, you know. But it's perhaps a generation thing. As I say, it was just expected, and nobody was applauding you within the band. You just got on with it. As soon as you come off, that's history. You get on with the next thing.
Yeah, an incredible work ethic that succeeded. Yeah.
It probably sounds strange. Well, not strange, but I mean, it'd be hard for you, being such a young musician, to understand it. And perhaps it's a generation thing. But to me, there's only one way to do it. If you've got to do it, you've got to be in it 110%. Mm-hmm. Rehearsals, concerts, everything. No excuses.
So you have your series of CDs, recordings, entitled The World's Most Beautiful Melodies. And for you to record, I think I'm correct in thinking there's 5 editions of the recording of the CDs. You must have come across some quite exquisite solos and melodies. Could you pick a top 3 solos? 5 solos, maybe, that you love to perform?
Wow.
Could you do that, or is that just an impossible question?
Well, it's a tough one. When we started this, because we had a relationship with Shandos, which started with the major parts and myself and the band, when that started breaking up, so to speak, in the sense of people going their own ways after 16, 17 years, whatever, Shandos didn't want to really carry on recording with brass bands. So that was slightly sad. Mm. But when we started the solo ones, I mean, I'd obviously done solos, you know, like when we do a Black Dyke album, LP, yeah, CD, whatever the period of time was, there would be perhaps a cornet solo on it. If it was a concert type recording, some of the recordings obviously would be test piece type original music sometimes for the brass band of the time. But then Shandos had this idea that, oh, we want to do a CD with Philip and the band. They said this beautiful melodies. So I couldn't see, obviously, what they were saying, because having had the experience with listening to me as Principal Cornet in the various band recordings we've been doing up to then, they must have seen something that would go out to the big world outside the bubble of the brass band movement. And so they said, oh, we want to do melodies. And being, I don't know, early 20s, you think, you know, I mean, as you, I mean, I'm not saying you think this way, but you really want to play all these big fancy solos, etc. So you're sort of biting your tongue a bit and saying, oh, okay. But you sort of, in a way, I mean, obviously thrilled that they want to do this, because it was only one CD. you really feel that they want to put the faith in you as a soloist. So you say, yeah, okay. Then the music starts coming to you. I'm not sure I had much choice with the first CD, whether I was involved with picking the repertoire or not. One or two of them already existed, but we did some with the organ. We did maybe three or four, I can't remember the exact number. And then the rest was with the band Black Dyke. And then that was, well, for me, it was amazing. I mean, they sold something like, well, then, so it's obviously more now. But then it was like 20-odd thousand CDs because people were buying it who just happened to hear it, if it got on the radio or this, who knew nothing about a brass band. They just thought, oh, I love that melody. I love this. I love that, blah, blah, blah. Like Major Parts used to say, they were probably just listening to it as they're doing the washing up or something, or the cleaning or the ironing and all this sort of stuff. And so it just took off. And then they had to do a second one. And for me, that I really enjoyed that one because half of it was with the Academy of St. Martin in the Field Orchestra in London. And some of them included a harpist, again, really famous harpist called Skylar Kanga. So for that half, I had to go down to London to record in a church with the Academy of St. Martin in the Field. And that, I think, is the most special part, not just because of the repertoire, but again, to combine a solo voice of a brass band cornet player with this amazing professional orchestra was just literally jaw-dropping for me. So that half of that CD was just, yeah, amazing. And to have all these wonderful melodies and arias from opera, etc., and folk songs, every type of what you might call famous tunes, as I say, it could be from opera, it could be from folk ballads of a day, to have them all done specially for you. And then to end up doing five is just incredible.
Yeah.
To pick any out, I think from a sentiment point of view, one of the first ones done for me was Dvorak, Rosalka's Song to the Moon.
Yeah.
So that has a special place to this day because some people still want me to play it last year, but just before the lockdown, I was out in Trondheim in Norway. And one of the ones that they really wanted me to play with the band was Rosalka. After that, I just love them all. I mean, there's some great Puccini. I loved playing Oh My Beloved Father. Mm-hmm. That was just two and a half minutes. But again, I just loved playing in that high register where, you know, in some octaves from middle B to high B, that type of trying to copy a human voice. Then there was a beautiful flower song from Carmen. I loved playing that. Softly Awakes My Heart from Samson and Delilah. The Puccini, there was just so many. Your Tiny Hand is Frozen. That was quite special. I could go on and on and on.
Yeah.
There was just, if you don't, me, you just have to love playing everything that's in front of you. If you don't, it's not going to come across. And the amount of time, I mean, well, you slightly know me from Hammond's helping out and playing on the Christmas concerts, but people that know me, I mean, the amount of time, five EDs, maybe going on for 100 solos in total, something like that. I mean, every one, especially when they were coming from opera or songs that I wasn't familiar with, I mean, I would research them all. I've got copies of the words, no matter what the language was, to actually shape the notation and the phrasing, etc., to fully express myself. And one of the ones, I mean, that's coming to mind now is Una Voce Poco Fa from Barbara Seville. I used to remember listening umpteen times to recordings of Maria Callas singing that to get all the fancy. I mean, because I didn't have a copy and I was doing it by ear with some of the recitatives and cadenzas that come in it. So I'm really trying to scribble out and get every note she went up to, et cetera, et cetera. But it was a great learning experience for me as well.
Yeah.
But something really special in my life, yeah.
Yeah. So moving on slightly, we've briefly mentioned about the years that you've spent committed to teaching brass at Huddersfield University. What made you so committed to wanting to teach and influence the younger generations of players, as you are still doing now? You're still influencing players now. What made you so committed to wanting to teach?
Yeah, another excellent question. I think I would have to say, to be honest, slightly it happened by accident. When I first started, I was still with Black Dyke as principal cornet in the early 80s. And there was a colleague of mine, a professional colleague of mine, a man who had nothing to do with brass banding. We used to do a concert each year with Black Dyke, one of the Christmas concerts in St. George's Hall in Bradford. And we used to do like a Friday night, Saturday afternoon, Saturday evening. So there was three concerts because it was so popular.
Yeah.
And the conductor, he wasn't the regular conductor of the choral, it was the Bradford Choral Society in Black Dyke. But the then conductor was the amazing David Wilcox, obviously the man who created all the wonderful Carol for Choirs books, etc. Mm. So again, you know, I mean, sitting there playing for him alone was a great experience. But in that choir, there was a gentleman called Derek Ramsbottom, who was head of music at Huddersfield Technical College. He lived in Queensbury. And I that was the only way I met him to begin with, although we became quite good friends. He's sadly no longer with us. But he was head of music at Huddersfield Technical College. So I'd studied music when I was younger, but then when I went there, I did a teacher training via the Huddersfield Poly, as it was before it became Huddersfield University. But I was full-time with Huddersfield Technical College. There was nothing at all. The age group of the students were sort of O-level, A-level, GCSE and A-level. So you would get them for 3 years, but there was no brass band or wind orchestra. So I literally, he wanted me to create this. Coming from Queensbury, he had this vision and he had the belief in me, which was nice. And he supported me absolutely beyond 100%. So I set about creating this brass band course at that level, for want of a better description of it. And I ended up getting people coming from, well, there were some students who would come from Switzerland. And this wasn't a degree level, as I say. So I had students coming from Switzerland, coming from the Northeast, Scotland, Cornwall. And we ended up with a fabulous quality of brass band and a wonderful wind orchestra. And it's from that brass band that I don't know how it would be. Not quite true for me to say I created it. I think I was pushed into creating it. But then I created Huddersfield Echol Band, as it was to begin with, which, because all these students were coming from different parts of the country and they wanted to do concerts, they wanted to do contests because they couldn't play with their own bands if they were down from over from Switzerland or down from Scotland, blah, blah, blah. So I created Echo, and for the first 12, 18 months, nearly 2 years, I was actually sponsoring it myself, you know, using friends to get music, buy music, stands for the banners. We had no uniforms, so we just had the sort of black and white. So I created Echo from that. And then along that same period, I was invited down to go in as a visiting tutor to the University of Huddersfield. Mm-hmm. And then I created a similar thing at a degree level, because again, when I first started there, I can remember going into what was a brass band rehearsal. There wasn't the numbers, there might have only been about 15. Mm-hmm. And most of them were trumpet players, trying to play a cornet or a French horn player, trying to play a tenor horn or even play the tenor horn pattern. So eventually, within a year or two, I'd built up a really good, I think, brass band. And the same with the wind orchestra, there was maybe 20 players when I finished. I'd built it up to about a proper symphonic wind orchestra, 50 to 60 players, and we did some amazing repertoire. But coming out of the tackle thing, doing a concert in Huddersfield Town Hall, and I just tongue-in-cheek said, if there's anyone in the audience who wants to sponsor a band, this was Huddersfield Tackle Band, all these young students. And lo and behold, David Armitage at Sellers phoned me up Tuesday or Wednesday after that weekend and invited me down, and the rest is history. We came in and sponsored Sellers in an amazing way, and we took Sellers on from, had to start in the fourth section or third section, I can't remember, came straight up, trying to fit it in with my playing at Black Dyke without obviously impinging on the Black Dyke. We came straight up and straight through to the finals at the Albert Hall at the first attempt as well, straight through to the from the Grand Shield to the Open, even though in, I think at the time we were still a second section band, but we still qualified for the Open. So, but the teaching aspect, it basically happened in that sort of way. What I enjoyed most, is hopefully two things. Obviously, I want to try and make the student a better musician, a better instrumentalist, to be the best they can be. I always try to instill, like I said earlier, don't have this mentality of trying to be better than someone else. If you try to be better than someone, you're not going to be really happy. You've got to play for your satisfaction, your enjoyment. Mm-hmm. And if you do that, people will enjoy listening to you and you feel happier and you get better. If you practice and put the time in with the right guidance and practice the right lesson plan of lesson exercises and repertoire balance, you will get better. But do not ever, ever try to be better than somebody else. Like you, if you think, oh, I want to be better than him or her, it won't happen. Mm-hmm. I've never, ever thought that. I just want to be the best that I can be. And it should be the same for you and everyone else. I've just wanted people to be improving and to be the best they can be. But on top of that, what's always been important from the first lesson or two, every time I see a new student, it's always giving them knowledge. It's more important for me that they understand what they have to do, mm-hmm. what goes with the exercises. We have perhaps some people who will say, practice this, practice that. And those in their own way are good exercises, good studies, etc., and will, with repetitiveness, improve the player. But for me, it's more important that they understand the thought process, what should I be doing when I'm playing this? And then if they get this knowledge into them, hopefully they will pass it on to other players. And so the right things will get passed on, not just the right exercises. That's, you know, playing those pages in the Arbiter, those pages in this, the knowledge that goes with it and the understanding that goes with it.
The question actually comes from one of the Brasscast's listeners. Mm-hmm. And their question was, what are some of your fondest moments as an educator?
Oh, now that is a question and a half. I think they're all. I think the reward. I know, like I said to you minutes ago with something else, I am very single-minded in my approach and in ensembles or individuals with regards to lessons. I've never ever compared anybody. If I'm teaching a cornet player, for example, and there's maybe 7 or 8 or 9 other cornet players I'm teaching as well, I'm not interested in whether Sophie's better than Fred or John's better than Ben. That is never part of it. What I really want is them to be absolutely the best they can be. And some of the greatest satisfaction is I've seen people when they've arrived in hindsight and I look back and when we've finished our course together, you think, and then you hear them playing with their bands after they've graduated, and you think, wow, you know, I taught him or her. And I think that's a great satisfaction. I mean, if I go and listen to the Yorkshire Areas or some other contest for that matter, and, you know, I mean, people will come up sometimes and they'll say, you must be really satisfied with all those students that you've got over the years that have been on stage and conducting. You know, people have got conducting as well. And I never see it at the time. I've never thought of it in that way. But there's a great satisfaction of seeing someone develop with the right knowledge, mm-hmm. and I mean, I'm pushing them as well, because I'm quite famous for pushing people, because I think a lot of us can be just reach a comfort zone. And, you know, I think we need someone. You're not always the most popular, and I know I'm not the most popular, but I believe in pushing someone further than they think they can go. And it's a bit cliched, but you've really got to sort of reach for the stars, and with a bit of luck, you'll hit the moon. So that analogy. But I think some people don't realise, if I just do a little bit more, then it's as simple as that. So, there's a lot of satisfaction when I see people in every sense, whether it's arranging music or conducting some of the bands. I mean, I see there's quite a lot of people I've been involved with when I think about it, conducting really well, mm-hmm. so like Elland. I mean, Danny Brooks was with me, Sam Harrison.
Yeah.
Then obviously people like Kirsty at Carlton Men. But there's people lesser known to the banding public who, in my eyes, have actually achieved more, if that makes sense. Because when I started with them, they're not stars. But when they finished, the progress they made is stunning. So the satisfaction is quite wide and emotional sometimes, especially, as I say, when I don't realise it, but then you see it. Your own band, Robert Jagger, he was one of my first students on Cornet, and he played for me with Teckle, Huddersfield Teckle, that became Sellers, 30 years on? He will never let you down on stage. He's an amazing character, an amazing personality.
Absolutely.
And that's the other thing, by the way, is the fact that a lot of the students, hopefully we'll say 90-odd%, they're passing on this commitment and dedication that we need to give to a band.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got another question here that comes from one of the Brasscast's listeners. And obviously you are still actively performing to the highest level. So what has helped you keep your playing so
consistent? And I'm assuming this has come from a listener that is older than myself, as they ask, how has ageing affected your playing?
I haven't aged. You know, I never have a birthday. You know, and I'm joking slightly, but I'm also not joking slightly. I have this mindset. I've never had a birthday because I believe, you know, if you look after yourself, I've never smoked and I've never really had a great deal of drinking experiences. I think if you look after yourself and have this, for me, I have a mindset that I'm as young as I want to be. Mm-hmm. And if you look after yourself, and the same with the playing. In fact, I was having a conversation just 2 or 3 days ago with the chief executive of Brass Bands England, Kenny Crookston, and he was talking about players who probably have not been practicing for 10 months, etc. And I'm thinking, you know, that can't enter my mind. Even now, I can't go out and, I mean, I should have done some solo things over the, like all of us. Mm-hmm. But even every day, I don't care what day it is, whether it's Christmas Day, New Year's Day, I still would do at least an hour and a half practicing. It's just motivation to do it. Motivation is probably the wrong word. It's just the passion and the love to do it. And I can't not do that.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a famous story with Black Dyke when we went to Australia, and the first concert was in Sydney Opera House. I mean, I would be in the toilet on the plane. I was in there 2 or 3 times for an hour. There was no way I was going to go to Australia, first concert, Sydney Opera House, and then not be absolutely where I want to be.
Mm-hmm.
Not just for me, but for the band. Yeah. I mean, some of the times I'd come out of the toilet on the plane and there'd be a queue halfway down the plane. But that's the extreme, single-mindedness, whatever, and that's all I'll do. And for practicing, I'm my biggest critic. When I'm practicing at home in this office, I will be angry with myself because I want to be today, I want to be better than I was yesterday and the same tomorrow. And touch wood. Like I said, if I thought for one moment that above all the sound, if that wasn't good enough, I would just stop for sure. Because there's no in between. I just love it.
So just recently you've joined the Geneva Group as a development consultant and performance artist, and subsequently, literally in the last few days, you've launched the international slow melody competition for young cornet players.
Thank you.
Which I was like, oh, that's such a great thing to see. Obviously, and there'll be young cornet players out there thinking, oh, should I enter this? What should I be playing for this? How do I make sure I have a great performance? So the younger people listening, or the teachers of the young players that will be listening, what would your advice be to the young people that are interested in entering the competition on having a great singing slow melody performance to enter into the competition?
Yeah, well, first and foremost, yes, please, please enter it. My idea was to encourage the younger players in particular. I could have just said, obviously being supported by Geneva, but I could have just said, let's just have a slow melody contest. But I really want to encourage and support young cornet players, hence the maximum age is 18. And then the overall winner, which isn't necessarily from the older group, it could be somebody that's 12, it could be somebody that's 14, the overall winner will receive one of the new cornets that I developed. So that's, you know, £3,000 of an instrument as a prize, plus the masterclass for the nine as a whole. So hopefully there's enough encouragement there. And like I say, I just really want to encourage this aspect of cornet playing, which has sadly perhaps a little bit or a bit more than a little bit disappeared in general. What I would say it suggests is, no matter what category, group-wise, age group-wise, that anyone's entering, I would just say find, and I would say this to a band playing a piece at a contest or any individual, you've got to find something that shows you at your best. Mm-hmm. Something you're happy with, something you enjoy playing, something that you love playing. Because if that's the case, you'll come across in that mm-hmm. same way. You'll come across at your best. It's like you. If I said, oh, you're going to play this solo at the next concert and you didn't like it, people will hear that you didn't like it. You played it just because. So please, these young people, just choose the vehicle that shows you off to the best and that you're happy and love playing. My suggestion would be the obvious songs, whether I've allowed them to be accompanied or not accompanied, the choice is theirs. But just choose the appropriate song or aria, melodic line. It could be a violin solo melody, any melody that they love playing and play well and are happy with. And that's the thing that will come across. And then what I want them to do, above all, is just express yourself. I mean, don't be afraid. And it's more difficult, I guess, when you're younger. But don't be afraid of using your feelings. I mean, is it something that's sad, or is it something that's romantic, or is it something that's happy? Are you asking a question? Does the song ask a question? Does the song make a statement? Think about the shape of the words, the phrases, and above all, when you're playing melodies, I think breathing has a big influence as well, because I see a lot of people that I've taught sometimes, and they're taking a breath unnecessarily just because they've not thought about it. Mm-hmm. So just think about your phrasing and the length of your phrasing, and going for that longer line in the phrases, and use your sound to shape those phrases. And if you've got the right approach with your breathing and your embouchure, and you've been taught properly in that sense, then you'll produce a good sound. Then use that good sound to express yourself.
The message to them is, go for it and good luck.
Yeah. It says competition, and I use competition rather than contest. I just want people to enjoy themselves and enjoy expressing themselves with the sound they make on the cornet. Mm-hmm. It's really, in some ways, in my mind, it's not a contest. The reward is for all these people to just go into it and enjoy the satisfaction that I and Kirsty Abbotts will, I can assure you, will listen to them all and just enjoy listening to them all and all the different approaches to making music. Mm-hmm. You can listen to the best orchestras in the world play the same symphony and they're all different.
Oh, absolutely.
But they're all fabulous.
Yeah.
And so it's just a matter of opinion. So I don't want people to think that it is a contest. Just enjoy playing.
It's absolutely brilliant that you've launched it. I think it's a great initiative.
Well, yeah,
for
players. Yeah, it's certainly going to be an annual event.
The final question that's come from our listeners is to do with this new Geneva Heritage Cornet that you've been in the development process of. And the question was just, can you describe the process that you've gone through to design and develop the cornet in as simply as possible? How have you created it and have made it the instrument that you wanted?
Yeah, well, I'm only laughing because, I mean, people that know me, they know for a start that if I'm going to make and develop a new cornet, there'll be no stone unturned, because and one of the reasons I've been invited by Geneva to join them, and one of the main reasons I accepted, was because if I'm going to develop a new cornet, there's no in between. It might not be an instrument. There's no perfect instrument for all people. One of the things I particularly want to do is to give people more choice. Mm-hmm. Because if you're going to spend £2,000, £3,000, £4,000, £5,000, £6,000, depending on the instrument, what you need to do. And sadly, there's not enough people do this. And I've seen students arrive with me and they've never tried another instrument, they've never tried another mouthpiece. And I'm not saying that what they're on isn't the right one, but at least compare. And then if you know you feel you're sounding the best you can on that combination, you play better and you're happier. But the main goal was to A, make the best instrument, the best cornet, I feel, that I could develop. So then you start from a blank canvas, because I didn't want, from Geneva's point of view, they already made what's considered to be quite a good cornet. I think it's called the Cardinal. I wasn't going to tweak that, for example. I had to start from a blank canvas.
Yeah.
So literally everything, I mean, I'll try and go through it very basically, very simply. When you put your mouthpiece into your instrument, the first inch, 2 inches, is what we call the mouthpiece receiver. I redesigned all of that because what's important, what people don't realize, from the end of your mouthpiece, the chank at the end of your, which is inside that receiver, and then the first part after the receiver that starts inside that receiver is what we call the lead pipe. And on a cornet, that then goes round to the tuning slide. So the gap, as it's known, between the end of your mouthpiece and the start of that lead pipe is absolutely critical. It all affects A, the sound, and the way it feels, the airflow for you through the instrument. I experimented umpteen times getting that right. Even the mouthpiece receiver itself, it's totally different to the one that's on the Cardinal. I ended up with a specific length. Then the shape and the taper of the lead pipe, which is the first crook part of it, the first bend round to the tuning slide. And even the tuning slide, the bend and shape on the tuning slide, the legs, the material of the legs on the slides, I tried different metals. Mm-hmm. It's amazing how with different metals on the legs, the legs being the part of the slide that goes inside the tube, that can change the sound and the blowing. I experimented with all the various metals on that. And coming out of the valve block, or out of the valves, out of the first valve for a cornet, then you have the bell. I experimented with different metals to make the bell, experimented with different shapes of the what we call the crook, where it comes out and then bends. One-piece bell, two-piece bell, different metals, obviously the flare on the bell, the size of the bell at the end, etc., etc. Even the position of the water keys, everything. So everything that from the moment you put your mouthpiece in to the sound coming out of the bell, anything that could influence that, I looked at, and not just one or two options, many options. And then also how it just feels and sits in your hand, because as soon as you hold your instrument, when you hold it, you need to feel it's part of you. The balance, the weight, and then when you put it to your embouchure, your mouthpiece goes onto your embouchure, not being too far away from instrument, so you're intimate with it. It's part of you. And it's that loving process when you play. And hopefully what I found, what I aimed for, I mean, you've kindly, very nicely mentioned all the way through this about the sound I make. What I was aiming for is a particular sweet singing quality of sound. And one that what I want for people is we want the same tone quality if you play the low C below the stave and go through chromatically up to a high C, the same sound on the high C, the same quality of tone, no matter what part of the register you're in. Then the intonation and all of that, I mean, it took me 12 months from start to finish. I feel I've ticked all the boxes and the smoothness of the airflow. There's things I can play now, slurring certain intervals, you know, like middle C up to high A or things like, they're just so much smoother. The airflow is much easier. And this is what, because after I'd completed it and they were beginning to be produced, I invited Kirsty up. She was the first person I invited up. She loved it within literally two or three notes. And things were so much easier for the intonation, just so much better. But for me, it's probably the best instrument I've been involved with developing since I was at Black Dyke when the old Sovereign.
Yeah.
For me, it really is. And it's made me, if any, and Kirsty said the same, it's made her and myself just enjoy playing the cornet even more. So, yeah, above all, if you're a cornet player and you've got a birthday coming up or Christmas coming up, whenever it is, at least try it. There's no perfect instrument for everybody, but it's one more, I think, top drawer quality, beautiful cornet for genuine, sincere cornet players who are looking for that sound and looking for that smoothness and ease of playing.
It sounds like you've done an incredible job, and sounds like from you even talking about it, sounds like you've loved developing it as well, which is great to hear too.
Oh yeah, for sure. As I say, I mean, it's okay. I mean, I never go into anything with it's going to be okay. It has to be the absolute best it can be, and I think it is. But that's up for people to try, and yeah. I hope they at least try it, and that's the success. But as I say, people that have tried it, Kirsty being the first, and everyone knows what a great player she is, with literally, and I left the room for her to try it. I didn't want to influence her in any shape or form, having taught her. She was left to her own devices. She just fell in love with it. And I think people will, if they try it properly, with an open mind. And don't be influenced, just try it, because if you feel happy on an instrument, you think, wow, I love this, you're going to play better and you're going to be happier. And that's what's happening. I'm really enjoying the playing I'm doing myself.
It's great to hear. Well, that just about rounds up all the questions I have for you. I could sit and talk to you about all things brass band related for hours and hours and hours, but it's this point that I'll end the episode. And I'd want to say a massive thank you to you, Philip, again, for featuring. It's been an absolute pleasure to be able to sit and talk to you and hear everything that you've got to say. It's been great for me to sit and listen and learn from what you've got to say as well. It's a really great opportunity for me to be able to talk to you like this. But for all of the audience members, listeners out there, thank you for listening. If you're a returning listener, thank you for coming back and listening again. And if this is the first time you're listening to the podcast, don't forget to check out our previous episode featuring euphonium player Morgan Griffiths. And don't forget to find the Brasscast on Facebook, Instagram, Spotify and Apple Podcasts. But this is it for this episode. I hope that you all tune in again soon. And once again, thank you again to Philip for being on this episode.
Oh, thank you, Zoe, for inviting. And anyone listening, tell all your friends and family and everybody that you know in the world in brass banding. Because Zoe's, I applaud everything you're doing. Bravo. And I will always support people like yourself, and keep singing with your tenor horn.
Thank you, Philip. That's all for now. Thank you and bye-bye.